This is Corolla Digital.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Before we get started, I want to take a quick call here. I also want to, let's do the call first. Let's get right to it. This is Erica. Erica?
Yes.
Hey, what's going on?
I had a question about memory loss.
Yes.
And, you know, I do feel that Jodi Arias, he didn't really have that amnesia that she talks about. However, I had a troubled childhood, abusive childhood, and I used blocking my memories for to cope.
So let's do this. There's several really interesting sort of topics you bring up here. One is you hang this question on Jodi Arias, and she claims that in a moment of extreme emotion, she blacked out. And that does happen. And I've seen it a lot with patients, particularly who have previous trauma, that they will gray out or black out or red out. They'll just say they just done nothing, and then all of a sudden, kind of come to. But they usually come to within a few minutes. So this business of, as she's saying, I'm in a fog, I don't know where that was, convenient. She probably has some vague quality of what went on and had some fogginess, but far different than what she presented in court.
Right.
Losing long-term memory is something that people have when they're in chronic distress. Some of that is the result of the effect of cortisol and other chemicals on the brain. In fact, kids that are in severe stress, when you do repeated MRI scans on them, the part of the brain that's associated with storing and long-term memory, the hippocampus, shrinks.
Mm-hmm.
It actually shrinks. So there's actually a neurobiology associated with a stressful childhood that prevents memory from being laid down, which I think is what you're talking about.
Yes, I don't remember. There was incest, rape. There was, things like that happened to me. I don't remember any of it. I might have a little flashback of a face or something like that. But it's followed me my whole life. Now I'm 44, and I couldn't tell you what school I went to.
Yeah.
I can't tell you if my classmates came up to me. I wouldn't recognize them.
No, that's sad. Well, here's the piece of the story you got to know, is that even though you don't have an explicit memory of this, even though you don't mm-hmm. have a long-term sort of screen memory or autobiographical memory of it, your body remembers it. So you have what's called an implicit memory. And your body, like you say, you have little flashbacks and little sensory experiences and boom, things kind of come back. And that's the part that has to be worked on in therapy. That's where you got to go to somebody who's a trauma specialist to kind of work that, connect that bodily-based experience back to your what we call narrative of your life. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Actually,
do you do any?
I've never met an anger specialist, so I'll have to research that. I live in Southern California.
Trauma specialist. Yeah, not anger. It's interesting you throw the anger in there because it's all wrapped in.
I'm probably very angry too.
Yeah,
I do see a psychiatrist for depression and anxiety.
Okay, well, you go back to the psychiatrist and say, look, I want to start doing therapy and I want a trauma specialist. This thing is something called EMDR, which is an eye movement therapy. It helps you sort of – there's all kinds of neurobiofeedback and things, way newer ways of connecting your body back to your consciousness, quite literally. And so you go talk to your psychiatrist about that. Okay, Erica?
Oh, yes.
All right. Good call. Thanks.
Right.
Interesting we're talking about memory right now because our friends at Lumosity.com have memory games that, frankly, I do every day. Adam swears by this. He thinks it's a way of sort of working out your mind or your brain the way you would work out your body. He associates it with, like, gym equipment, like Lumosity, his gym equipment. So we all work hard. We try to stay in shape. But the brains need to stay healthy, too. And it's interesting that we just had this conversation about memory. I actually do the I had to look up. There's one memory game they do, which is sort of recalling patterns of boxes in a pattern. And I do it all the time because it does seem to create a focus. And it does seem to be doing something. So Lumosity.com is where you go. They base this stuff on the science of neuroplasticity. The goal is to have sharper, more focused memory and attention for meetings, problem solving, that sort of thing. So what I want you to do is start your training at Lumosity.com today. Go there right now. Click the Start Training button to train free. You actually will find these games to be kind of interesting and fun. And tell them you heard it from me, Dr. Drew. And if you do this regularly, you'll actually see your progress. They give you a sort of a report card every day that you can check how you're improving with these games. And Mr. Corolla's pirate ship stays afloat, and you will benefit at the same time. Lumosity.com. Go there right now. Click on Start Training and have fun with that. Now, next up, I'm welcoming to the program, re-welcoming, right? He's coming back, Brandon Stogsdill. One of the reasons I brought him back is we will be, you can get his book, The Boy with the Gun, on our website. Click through at Amazon, The Boy with the Gun. It's there right on the website at drdrew.com. I published this book for him. I thought you'll see my whole story with him in the intro, and actually we tell it. You know, we will hopefully get into it today, and exactly how we met and how this happened, because it's kind of interesting, and why I wanted to publish this book, because it's an important story, and it's really a case example of how people can change. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. Thank you all for all the support you've been giving us. As I've said in the last couple podcasts, Corolla has been giving me not the pat on the back, but a little bit of a nod lately. Like, I think for a while there, I think you were doing really good with the Amazon click-throughs because he was like, hey, man, good job. Right? You notice that?
A head nod's like a hug.
Head nod, well, for Adam, it's like a touchdown dance. But the pat on the back was like extraordinary. It's like, wow, okay, man.
Yeah, but that's kind of scary because you have to question that. It's a little too warm.
Well, of course, it's a little weird. Yeah, I'm not used to I'm not used to eye contact, guys. So when I get a nod, it's like, holy shit, what have I been doing right here? But it's you all that have been supporting the Dr. Drew Podcast through clicking through at the Amazon link at drdrew.com and also the swinging sounds of Dr. Drew Podcast available on iTunes. You just heard a sample of one of the pickings there, and we just put together a group of groovy songs we thought you guys would like, and we'll come out with more shortly. And, of course, please don't forget to support the people that support the show and make it possible. We want to keep doing these things, and as long as you support them, we keep doing these podcasts. And I am grateful for you all being interested in the things I'm interested in. And today, I'm happy to bring back to the program Brandon Stogsdill. He is a young man whom I met in, of all places, Puyallup, Washington. And when we started sort of developing these things and I realized there were people that sort of wanted to hear our thoughts and, you know, listen to these podcasts, I wanted to put on my website at drdrew.com things that kind of interested me that I thought were funny or thought interesting or important that didn't have other platforms from which to reach out to people. And so I put the 3 and 5 minutes with Mike's on there, which I think are sort of brilliant little studies and into an interesting man's head. And the other thing that I've been looking forward to doing and now have done is putting an ebook up, Brandon Stogsdill's ebook. It's called The Boy with the Gun. It's a book that you can click through at Amazon. I wrote the foreword on this book, and it's Brandon, let's just tell the story. You and I came to know one another in Puyallup, right?
That's correct.
And
in
what happened?
The outer suburbs of Tacoma. What's that?
I tried to tell the story as I remembered it in the foreword, and I have a feeling my memory was a little bit inaccurate. How do you remember that having gone down?
I basically listened to your show while I was in prison for 3.5 years and always tried to call the show when I got released to just kind of share how important you were and helped me change my life. And unfortunately, the love line was always busy. So I ended up hearing you were coming to speak at the place I got my associate's degree at Pierce College. And I, you know, networked with everyone. I said, hey, whatever you do, you got to make it to where I can meet Dr. Drew. I have to tell my story. I have to thank him. And they were like, all right, well, we'll see what we can do. Didn't know what was going to happen. And then the day of, they said, all right, well, we got you to meet him in the green room. So you were prepping in the green room for your speech.
It felt like it wasn't even the green room. Like maybe it was even like, did we first meet like outside the green room, like in the audience area or something? That's my weird memory of it.
I remember specifically. So first met in the green room. You were prepping for your speech, yeah. Getting through the tough years. And then I just kind of like cleared my throat, looked at my friend, and she's like, nodded, go for it. And I was like, hey, I have to tell you something. Everybody kind of looked at me awkwardly.
And there were a bunch of people. There were a bunch of people around, right?
Yeah, there was a bunch of people. Yeah. And then I just blurted out my story as quickly as I could and then just thanked you for how important you played a role in. And I said, yeah. And after you stood up and shook my hand, and I said, I have a book that I've been writing on, and I have a chapter devoted to you and Love Line.
Okay, hold on. Stop there. Because
okay.
My memory was I was kind of distracted. And I was meeting a bunch of people or doing a bunch of stuff and kind of getting ready. And I wasn't paying attention to you at first, but I was kind of like listening with one ear, right?
Yeah.
And then something about you really, you came into like focus all of a sudden. And I was like, whoa, something's going on here. And and I started listening to the story and the depths of the feeling attached to what you were describing, the sort of amazing character, the story, and then the intensity of your gratitude, it was just like you were like in full focus in about 2 minutes. And then you offered the book. Then
yeah.
Tell me that.
And I was like, and I wrote this book and just devoted my life to it. And I got this chapter. And I said, I would love it if you could read the chapter. And you were like, God, I don't want to read the chapter. And then all of my motivation, inspiration just kind of like started to fade away. And then you were like, I don't want to read the chapter. I want to read the whole book. And then I was just like, you got to be kidding me. And I didn't think you were serious. And then afterwards, you gave the speech, which was incredible, which was awesome and funny, like always. I went and I purchased your book, Cracked, and you signed it, and which was really cool. Still have that today. And then you said, you'll see me later. And I said something like, you will see me later. And you were like, you looked at me assuredly like you would. And then you had your contact, write down your email or your contact. And then once I got the book, I sent it to you. And then I didn't know what was going to happen after that. And then you read it and emailed me back. And it was like 2 pages of email, how much you appreciate it. And I was just excited. I was super excited that out of all the people in this world, the one person in the world that I would love to read the book was you. And not only did you read it, you appreciated it and had a lot of good things to say about it.
It's an amazing story. And I want to share it with the world because I did not create this book. You did, my friend. And I had the great privilege of bearing witness to it. Did you give me a chapter there in Puyallup or something? I remember reading something in Puyallup, I thought. No?
No, I didn't.
Because I remember once my memory was I got the book and, well, so my memory's wrong. But I can tell you for sure, here's what happened when I got it, because I remember this vividly. I was trying to decide if I was really going to read it carefully or not, or just kind of, you know, just kind of move around. And it fell open to some. My memory is that some of that transitional stuff when you were in prison, and I was just like, holy shit, I got to read this thing all the way through. And I devoured it, I would say. So there we were, and that was how many years ago?
That was in 2007, and on that same night, I landed a literary agent. The first time I ever tried to get an agent, I landed a literary agent the same night as well.
Well, the book is good, and that's why you got both of our attention. And so anyway, all the way along, I've been looking forward to you. Well, and since then, Brandon has gone on in his training and in his professional career and become a very high-quality therapist, particularly for young people and troubled males, troubled youth. And now are you in the final phases? Where are you at now?
Right now I am a licensed mental health counselor, a child mental health specialist, and a chemical dependency professional. I work for Sound Mental Health, the largest mental health agency in King County, and I started my own private practice, Premier Therapeutic Experience, last year, and it's growing really quickly.
I'm not surprised. And all the way, Brandon's been like, well, should I get this degree or should I? I'm like, yes, go get it. Go get it. You can do it. No problem.
Yeah, and let me just say, like, I listened to you in prison, which you were the first person to kind of, like, break through this wall that I had up. And not only was I able to trust you, like, I took your advice in prison. And even when I got out, you believed in me from the start. You told me even I was never good at school, and you were like, you should get a PsyD. And I didn't even know what a PsyD was, which is a doctor in clinical psychology. And I was like, all right, I will. And the doctor degree in my mind wasn't even there 2 years ago. And that was while I was just getting my bachelor's degree. And then from there, you went on to help me, guide me on some projects. You helped me with my girl problems even. and not only guided me to get my PsyD, you helped me land. I got accepted to 2 doctorate programs, one in California and one in Washington this coming fall. And, like, again, I just thank you for all that and for believing in this book and spearheading the publication of this
book.
Well,
it's my pleasure, but you make it sound like I did the work. I did the easy part. I just, like, stood – I was like a cheer, like, go, Brandon, go, go. That's all I did because I could see what you had. I know when people have talent. I know it. And I know when they have drive and when there's no reason that they shouldn't be able to reach out to the next stage in their training if they wish to. And it was just clear to me. It was crystal clear who you are and what you have to offer. And so – I knew I couldn't be the only person that would see that, so there's just no way. So there we are, and now we have ourselves someone with an immensely important life experience to share, both in the form of this book and as an individual or group therapist, someone who can really understand deeply. Nothing more important sometimes with certain groups and certain psychological, psychiatric problems than me too. I know what you're talking about, man. I've been there. That immediately creates a connection that you cannot forge any other way. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay. So Brandon was also with us on episode 14. He told his story. You can listen to that original interview if you wish there. But let's go through the story. A reminder again, you can get The Boy with the Gun at Amazon. Just click through at drdrew.com and download the ebook. Do we know what it costs? $8.99. It's money well spent, and it will support Brandon. Support the Corolla Pirate Ship, but it will support Brandon and be a really important source for him of, again, further encouragement as he goes on in his career. But let's tell the story. So it started. You grew up where and how?
I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and basically my mother had an incident where she was a victim of rape, from what I understand, and she became pregnant, and her friends persuaded her to get an abortion, and she, however, refused, and she said, when I was born, my eyes were wide open, and I looked curiously around the room as if I was waiting for the wonderful possibilities before me, and at 4 years old, my first memory was just like standing in front of my house, eagerly waiting for the bus to pick me up to start school, but I was too young. And I even saw myself going to the UW, even though I never knew anybody to go there, and wearing a business suit to work in a skyscraper.
Huh.
But unfortunately, the next memory was my mother passed out drunk on the ground. And she had multiple mental illnesses, addiction. We were on welfare.
And she was alone, of course, right?
Yeah, and she had a boyfriend off and on, and some other boyfriends that would come and go. So, and then I'll just...
In retrospect, can you characterize her mental illness?
I think it was post-traumatic stress disorder from something severely happened to her when she was a young girl.
So we could surmise, again, young women that are raped often were sexually abused in childhood. That's why they become an object of rape. They freeze when these guys come at them and they can have their way. So maybe sexual abuse.
Correct.
And that creates personality stuff and PTSD. And then addiction.
Yes. And that's pretty much how I would look at how she coped with her pain from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also possible she had bipolar. So, and then at 4 years old, I was molested by a neighbor. Again, I had no idea what this meant. I do know when I was younger, I tried to pretend it never happened. I was ashamed of it. I was confused. And it wasn't until years later that I realized from you speaking to another caller that was not my fault. I could not have initiated that.
No.
And that was just so important for me to hear, and that was why you played such an important role in my life.
And a reminder, too, again, to frame that, if you don't mind me jumping in as we tell your story, the women that were sexually abused strangely bring around perpetrators to their kids. The thing that horrifies the most, again, there's a crazy pattern that humans get into. When things terrorize us the most, we recreate them in our adult life. So she recreates the trauma over and again. She gets raped. And then she recreates it in the child, too, by being attracted to perpetrators. So she probably thought that neighbor was a cool guy and let him hang around. And all of a sudden, boom, here we have another generation.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. And then that just caused a lot of confusion. So it led to a lot of insecurity. And I was never good at school. Like I remember very clearly in second grade, I cried out loud obnoxiously in class because I couldn't add double-digit numbers. Mm. I was always confused, always a step behind. And then just started getting really depressed. And
how old were you when you first started feeling depression? How old were you?
I think it was, I don't know if I could pinpoint it, but it had to be elementary because I just remember just life was just so dull and plain and there was no really hope to look forward to. I just remember maybe fifth grade.
Mm.
And then
did you realize it was depression, or again looking back you call it depression?
I had zero idea what it was. Yeah. When I was a kid, only like from going through college, listening to you, I was able to start putting these pieces together.
Yeah.
And then with that depression just came acting out. I could say now it was definitely like conduct disorder, childhood onset, where I started to steal from the 7-Eleven candy bar, started to steal more, started to, you know, break into cars. At 10 years old, we broke into my fifth grade school and stole stuff, and stole like pop whistles and stamps and candy. And that was the first time I got arrested when I was 10.
Mm.
And then I pretty much just lied to the officers and told them we got it from a garage sale. And I didn't really get into much trouble from that. And again, things just kept going the way they did, and they kept getting worse. And then,
what happened to your mood disturbance? Did you think some of the conduct stuff was a response to the mood?
I definitely, looking back, it feels like I was trying to control it. Uh-huh. Like everything's boring and dull, so why don't I do something exciting?
Uh-huh.
To try to control it.
That could have been that could have been addiction too. Do you have addiction? I forget.
No, I have. I may have love addiction.
Well, we'll get to that chapter later. So.
Yeah, that's definitely another chapter, actually another book. But I never drank alcohol, never did drugs
okay,
in my
so
life.
Not
even
addiction,
though
just, it's just
surrounded
the,
by it.
It's just that flat emptiness. Yeah, okay, I got it. So you now, yeah. Where are we now? Seventh grade, eighth grade?
Yeah, seventh grade, and then I met a girl, like one of the girls who only paid attention to me, and I latched onto her, and I just kind of just gave her everything, gave her all my time, kind of let go of the friends that the little friends that I did have, and just really felt like if I treat her really great, she's going to treat me great, and the more I treated her better, or the better I treated her, the worse she treated me. Oof. And we did this for like around 2 years until 10th grade. I got a call from a friend that she was kissing another guy at a Tolo. And we were broken up, to be fair, but I still thought we were going to get back together. But it devastated me. Mm. And on top of that, my mother was committed into a mental institution. Mm. I remember I came home, 10th grade, and she was spinning in the front room, singing in a little girl's voice, Ring Around the Rosie. And it just really it just upset me, but I acted like I didn't care, and I left. So she was committed to a mental institution. My first love broke my heart. I was failing school. I had no plans on ever going to college. That was never anywhere in my mind, and then that's when the depression really hit. And 10th grade, I remember just walking around by myself behind the hallways, avoiding people because I thought everybody was better than me. Ugh. I felt like a loser, and just not only did I think about suicide, I would just fantasize about it.
Mm. And what was the motivation for suicide? To end the pain, or what were you thinking?
To end the pain, to see if people would pay attention, they would then realized that I was important if I was gone, just this distorted thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then after
who was
10th
taking
grade,
care of you? Your mom was institutionalized. Who stayed with you at home?
My sister, I went to live with her on a military base, Fort
wow.
Lewis.
Wow.
So and that lasted for a little bit, and then my mom came out, and then I went back with my mom. And I remember I could have went and lived with my sister in Okinawa, but I decided to stay with my mom.
Okinawa. And your sister, did she have any kind of connection? Because she understood what the mom was all about?
Yeah, my sister, and it's hard for me to talk about my family, but I feel like it's all good stuff. But
hard because you don't want to divulge anything?
Yeah, or okay. Just make them upset.
I understand.
But I do say this in my book. She ended up getting pregnant at 17 and just moving out as soon as she could.
Yeah.
And she got with a special forces soldier, and they pretty much went their own way. But she was a human, important part. I remember I had a conversation with her when I was 7 years old, and I was talking about how my mom was raped and how I was born, and I was really ashamed of that. Like, I was a mistake, and, like, I wasn't supposed to be here on this planet. And, man, it almost makes me choke up. But she just looked at me, and she said, you know, you were here for a purpose and that you were meant to be here. And so she was really important.
Nice. She may be the reason you survived.
Possibly.
Do you thank her for that now?
Oh, yeah.
And is this in the book? This part?
Yeah, it is in the book, and I also, in the book, there's a point to where I start coming to realize that I was the bad guy in prison when I was in this orange jumpsuit when this family saw me, and they kind of grabbed their kids because they were scared of me, and that's when I realized that I was the bad guy, and I wanted to explain myself, but I had nobody to explain myself to, so I wrote a letter to my sister, and I wrote her how I ended up getting to prison, but not anything in my childhood, because I did not yet understand it until I started listening to your radio show.
Interesting. Did you ever want to be the bad guy? Because I know a lot of people. I've talked to recovering folks once in a while. In fact, I had a therapist I worked with once, who said he was a kid and he was watching The Godfather, and when they were into all the violent scenes and stuff, he thought to himself, "This is what I want to do. This is my career." I thought, "Wow, that is I didn't know people had that thought when they're watching horrible films about horrible people." Did you ever experience anything like that when you were in your oppositional defiant phase?
Never. I remember watching like DuckTales, and I was always rooting for the good guys, and I always, I was always the good guy. And even when I was making the bad decisions, as we'll get into sooner, I thought I was like a vigilante, some crazy distortion. I could tell you a little bit more about that when we get there.
Is that in the book?
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going.
So the 10th grade year was just, I was depressed, pathetic, just no friends, suicidal. And the end of 10th grade year, I don't remember why, but I shaved off my head or my hair with a razor, and I just remember just saying, fuck this. I'm sick, I'm tired of feeling this way, and I decided not to care. And by not caring, I started fighting. And these weren't just little fights. There would be blood splattered all over my fists and forearms, and I'd go into the next fight with my hands still raw. And essentially, looking back, I could say I was really hurt and sad about a lot of things in my past, and it was way easier to act aggressive and mean to people, and that's what I did, and I did it as best I could.
Who did you fight?
Anybody that would look at me a dirty way or a wrong way.
Let me ask you, again, I'm just poking at things as we move through the story. Again, the book is The Boy with the Gun. You can get it on ebooks, Amazon at doctor.com. Get the book. I wrote the foreword. I encourage you. This is, I know we're digging our way through the bad stuff now, but there's a lot to this book about change, and that's very important as we telegraphed at the beginning of the conversation. How do you have any sense now how you could reach somebody like that in that state if you come across them? I've tried to. I can't.
That has been, I mean, that was a key point in changing my life around and giving me purpose to try to help people to prevent them from ending up where I went into. And I know for me, it's to accept, for my clients, just to accept them where, no matter where they are. Just accept them, I love them, and just listen to them. And they just want to be heard and they just want to be accepted and not try to control them and tell them what to do, because nobody could have told me what to do. At least that's what I thought.
So let me get a little more specific. If I came across you at that time, let's say I just ran into you here at the Corolla Studios, how would I get you to sit with me and just let me even trust that I would listen to you or care that I would listen to you?
I think it's a relationship. It's building a relationship, I think, is probably the key.
Yeah. So it's spend time, commit, Hank, stay with that person, right? Don't reject them. Just try to forge some kind of connection.
Yeah, and I've known over the years working with clients, like most of them come in, they don't want counseling, and they have their wall up. But once they get to know you, they get to trust you, like their wall starts to crumble and they start to open up. And
remember the movie? Do you ever see the movie Antoine Fisher?
Love Antoine Fisher, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
I actually got to meet him too.
No, the real guy?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yep.
Well, do you remember the part where he was sort of oppositional defiant?
Yeah.
And the psychiatrist made him just sit in his office with him?
And he wouldn't say anything.
Right. He just had him sit there.
Yep.
I thought that was a great example of what a lot of people need, just tolerating being around somebody and then forging some kind of closeness slowly.
Yep, and not judging them and just accepting them and goodwill hunting as well as the counselor. He just didn't try to force them, and he let the clients be quiet until they were ready to talk.
Interesting. All right, so now you're fighting with everybody. You got blood on your hands. What happens?
I started to get respect and recognition, and I started to gain a lot of friends, and it made me feel good.
So in a weird culture of oppositional, defiant, and sociopathic males, you had stature. You had status.
Yeah, and from where I'm from, Tacoma in Washington, like, the gangs were really bad in the Hilltop area, and there was a lot of respect and prestige into that lifestyle, including, like, Scarface and Godfather and all that. So I started to gain respect quickly, and it just motivated me. And here's something I don't usually tell people a lot, but my brother, again, he's my half-brother, but I consider my full brother, he got punched in the stomach one time by these thugs for no reason after a motorcycle accident. And from what I understood, that could have killed him because of his medical issues. Mm-hmm. And little did I know at the time, I started to gain this hatred towards these type of people. And these were the people that I fought. And these were, like, I thought were the bullies and tried to hurt other people, and they would initiate the fights with me, and I would not back down to them.
How would I identify them? Who were they?
You know what's funny? I feel like they were like me. They were people.
There's another version of you.
Yeah, they were just people that were let down in life and hurt and had a chip on their shoulder and had to prove something. Hmm. So we're like fighting each other, fighting ourselves, which is kind of sad, and I see it a lot today. So I just kept fighting and eventually messed with the wrong people, and these guys were talking about killing me.
How old are you?
16, mm-hmm. And they were calling my house, threatening me. I remember I even called the police, but the police were like, we can't do anything. And then I was literally scared for my life. It was after a huge fight that went down with, like, dozens and dozens of people. And then the next day I go to school, and another guy's like, hey, you remember that other guy you got in a fight with? Well, he has a gun and he's looking for you. So 16, I ended up getting a gun for protection. I got a .357 from a friend in the boys' bathroom during high school.
How did he get it?
He got it from his crew, just went jacking one night and found it in the car, and they stole it. So they sold it to me, and that was the first gun that I got, and I carried it everywhere I went. I carried it to school every single day.
It was loaded?
It was loaded. And I went to the fairs, I rode my bike with it, And what happened was initially I was really just kind of nervous with it, but I got comfortable with it. And then the first thing that happened, went to a 7-Eleven again, and again the guy was staring at me aggressively. I look at him like, "What are you looking at?" And he flips me off, and I was like, and he jumps out of the car, and I was like, "You know what, man? I don't know you." And he's like, or you know, first he said, he's like, "You don't know me," and I was like, "Yeah, I don't know you. I don't have a problem with you." And by this time, I had the respect, I had the recognition, I even had the Hall of Fame yearbook, Daring Devils, which is like a popular category, and which I later learned translated and most likely to go to prison.
Oh my God.
So, because I created a Facebook page for the boy with the gun, and I'll put these pictures up too. But
what is Facebook / boy with the gun or the boy with the gun?
Yeah, it's going to be Facebook, just the boy with the gun.
The boy with the gun, okay.
And then, yeah, so I had friends now. I had respect. I didn't even need to prove myself. I had people out to kill me. I had a gun on me. Wasn't worried about this guy. My hands were still hurt from all the other fights. So he jumps out. I literally say, "Hey, I don't have a problem with you," and I try to go around him, and then his buddy comes from behind me, and they're like, "We're about to show you who we are." And I swear I didn't feel like I did anything to provoke it, and then they surrounded me, and then I was like, "You know what?" So I pulled out the gun, and then something happened that I never anticipated, which was this intense just surge of power. As these bullies are proceeding on me, they see the gun, and then their knees start to buckle, and they back up, and their eyes widen, and I became addicted to that power.
That feeling.
Yep. And then the next thing that happened, we'd go to a party, get into a fight. And I remember this guy was laying on the ground, and we were going back to the car, and his friends came out of the house. And the guy in the middle, I could see the shine of his gun, and he pointed it out, cocked it back, pointed at me. So I grabbed my .357 and pulled it out and pointed at him, and I walked backwards to the car. And we got into the car. It was actually a Volkswagen bus. And we started to drive away, and they started shooting at us. And I pulled out my gun without even thinking, and I didn't shoot at them. I shot in the sky just to scare them because my gun was louder, and this is what happened. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got in trouble. And even if I did, I was just a kid, and this became my distorted reality.
You're 16 still.
16.
Yeah. Keep going.
Yep, and then it just came to the point. I could tell you every last story, but it just came to the point. If you looked at me wrong, if you hit me up with a gang sign, even though I wasn't a gang member or flipped me off, I would just shoot. And I thought I was taking care of bad people for some distorted reason. And I remember we talked in the last podcast, but I swear like something like was preventing some of these bullets from hitting people, because I don't know how it was happening, but I was like the Wild West, and I was pretty lost, and there was no consequence.
How many times do you think you pulled out the gun and shot?
Oh, probably like 7 or 8 times. Mm-hmm. Even for random things, like someone would drive down the street and shoot a firework at us, I'd shoot. It was just ridiculous.
And you say us. Were you running with particular guys at that point?
Yeah, I had a group of friends. And, yeah, we kind of just I had a very diverse group of friends. I had friends that were, like, preppy, some friends that were actually gangsters from opposing different gangs, and some friends that were just kind of, like, stoners. Rocker dudes, some bike riders, and just had a lot of different friends.
And while you were hanging out with all these different kinds of guys, they knew you had a gun on you?
Yeah.
Did they like that? They talk about it?
I think they respected it. I have another picture I'll put up on Facebook. We have pictures of us holding the guns, because a little later I started buying more guns. Actually, at the peak of everything, I had a sawed-off shotgun under my rug near the window. I had a .22 pistol underneath a chair, and then I had my .357 underneath my pillow, and then bullets kind of in random different places, like my die-cast cars. Just craziness.
And where was your mom during all this?
She was kind of just around.
And your sister was gone, right?
She was gone. My brother, he went to move with his dad, and yeah.
Was her mental illness and drug use more stable then, or was it still out of control?
I feel like people say I talk badly about my mom, but I feel like she did the best she could.
Hey,
I mean,
and by the way, 2 points. A, don't talk about it if you're going to hurt her. I feel compassion for your mom. She had bad illness, and I hope she didn't get care. It's just more of a testament to how shitty men are for taking advantage of an abuse survivor, and then how shitty our system is for not helping her, right?
Yeah. And I agree with you, and that's why I decided to share the story. But some people always come back like, "You shouldn't say that." But my mom, I feel like my mom did her best. She took care of me. She didn't abort me.
Well, maybe it's people don't really have the perspective that those of us that work in and around mental health do.
And that's what I believe as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. When we talk about someone being sick and not being able to do their job as a parent or whatever, that's not condemning somebody. That's shaking the head going, oh, it's so sad. That's all. Anyway, yeah, so she was sort of around, and she sounded more stable, though, at that point, right?
Yeah, I remember the drinking was constant. Again, I just remember she would be drinking a lot, smoking cigarettes, talking on the phone a lot, and I kind of just did whatever I wanted. I would sneak, even at 10, I was sneaking out of the house. At 15, I was having girls stay the night, just kind of doing whatever I wanted. And if she tried to put any punishment on me, I would be very aggressively back and being manipulative and all that terrible stuff.
She couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
All right, so now keep going forward. We're about 17 now?
Yeah, and then so my friends become the most important thing in my life. And then early morning, and this is the beginning of the book, my buddy comes over, and he's pretty upset. My other friend's just beat up, mangled, just mangled. And it just made me sick to my stomach to see him like that. And my friend tells me how some guys jumped him and how they were still talking crap. So he didn't even need to finish the story. I grabbed my 357 early that morning. I left with them to go meet these people. Well, we ended up getting a group of friends, I think four cars, about 16 people. And we went to meet these guys. And the whole day I'm tense, I'm anxious. And I knew in the back of my mind that I should just go home. But I didn't want to let anybody down. So here we go. We meet them. The prosecuting attorney made it seem like we surrounded his car, and my friends approached them, and these guys started laughing, and then just kind of fueled the intention that was already increasing. And again, words were exchanged. I couldn't hear anything, and it starts to go down, and this is the moment. So my friends, I'm thinking, you know what? Expect me to do something.
Well, what starts to go down? What happens?
They start just arguing, screaming, and it's just happening. And then all of a sudden, the guy tries to get the car in gear, or somebody does something, and then my friend next to me throws something at the car, and it smacks the car, and somebody else throws something, and then I'm thinking, you know what? Nobody's going to get hurt. Nobody's getting in trouble. I pull out the pistol. I point it at the car, and even if I do get in trouble, I'm just a kid, and I let two rounds explode from the barrel, and as those bullets were speeding through the sky, at that point, I realized that I wasn't the good guy. I was the bad guy now. I wasn't taking care of bad people. I was making this world worse, and I need to stop. But unfortunately, those bullets sped through the sky, penetrated through the trunk, and lodged into a speaker magnet inches away from their neck or from their heads. Mm-hmm. So thank God nobody was injured. But unfortunately for me, they sentenced me they arrested me, and they charged me with assault, too, with a deadly weapon.
Now, how did the rest of that altercation go? How did the cops get involved? How did they find you?
So we drove off that night. Everybody went in different directions.
So people scattered after the gunshots.
Yeah, and there was multiple gunshots, too.
Somebody else was firing?
That's what it seemed like. I heard four gunshots or three gunshots, but nobody – there was other guns involved, but I don't know what else happened. But I know we ended up crossing across the Narrows Bridge, which – spans like I'm over a mile between the two areas, and I got off to ditch my gun, and for some reason I didn't want to get rid of it, like I was connected to it. The editor, Jed Dawson, who did a great job working on the book, he said that the gun almost became a character. So I kept the gun, and I put it underneath the truck bed cover, and we went off, and we went to a pool hall, and it was 1999. And we paged a couple of our friends, and there were some other friends there. And even this other guy that had a problem with tried to fight me there. But he heard about the gun, and he was like, oh, what happened with the gun? So he kind of backed down a little bit. So we ended up, I was going to stay at the pool hall, but it was 2 in the morning. We're like 20 miles from where it happened, so we decided to go home. And as we're driving home, all of a sudden a police car is tailing us. And it doesn't have his lights on, but it's slowly behind us. And then at that point, I started to give an alibi to my friend. I said, hey, you just picked me up from the pool hall. I've been there all night. And then he said he was at his girlfriend's. And then all of a sudden we pass a cop car on the side of the street, and it abruptly skids out, does a U-turn, follows a second car. And about a few minutes, there's about 5 police cars behind us, and then they light up all the lights. And I was not nervous at all.
Huh.
And we pulled over, and they searched the gun. And I remember just sitting in the back of the police car, and they just kind of looked like little fruit flies just devouring an old plum or something. And I remember one cop shined his light right on where the gun was hidden, but they just kept looking, and they didn't find the gun, and they were going to let us go. And then right as they were going to let us go, somebody, and I lied to him. I said I was at the pool hall, and then somebody said we were there, so they took us to the jail back at the scene.
They found the gun?
Nope, they never found the gun.
Hmm.
And they took us back, and I just lied again, and they let us go, and they charged everybody with assault 4, and then a couple months later, everything just faded. Nobody got in trouble, nobody got hurt, and I'm kind of smirking like I always did, like I got away again. And these detectives roll up to the house, and I was like, I think I was working on schoolwork, trying to graduate, because I was failing a lot. And they came in, I knew I didn't have to let them in, and I wasn't nervous, and they're like, so why don't you tell us what happened that night? And I was like, I already told you what happened. And they're like, well, you know, you are on camera. Why don't you tell us what happened? And I said, if I was on camera, why don't you tell me what happened?
Cool.
So I knew they didn't have anything on me, because if they did, they would have arrested me. So
yeah.
they needed me to tell them. And I wasn't nervous. And then something just happened inside of me. Like, must have been my conscience or all this stuff from the past, because I did a lot of just terrible things, like breaking into houses and driving around stolen cars and selling drugs at school. But the conscience just came out, and I just wanted to tell him.
Let's talk about that moment. Because sometimes people do sort of confess and get caught or whatever it might be. Can you break that moment down a little bit? What was that?
I think I was tired. Mm-hmm. I was tired of people after me. I was tired of being scared of the cops getting me in trouble with the gun. I was afraid, I was getting patted for guns at school by the principal.
Did you reflect back on the moment when you shot, when you said you had this sort of epiphany there that you'd become the bad guy? Was that moment coming to the present there?
I don't remember that, but that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But it definitely just hit me, and I just was like, I'm tired, and I just want to get it off my chest. And I ended up telling them what happened, other than what happened with the gun, because that was still in my room.
The gun was still in your room?
Yeah.
Many guns were in your room, right?
Yeah, and at that time, only one gun was left, because things started to really die down. And I literally, I felt like I needed to change, because it was just going pretty bad. So I started to try to focus on school and started even getting depressed again. And what's funny is the cops wanted to know if I had any bullets that night. Or bullets in my room, so I told him I did. And in my room, I had the graffiti stuff in black light ink, and it said, F the police. and I'm showing them my room and showing them all the black light stuff, and I was just about to show them that. And then right as I saw it, I was like, oh, I probably should not let them see that, so I turned it off. But just funny stuff like that. And they didn't arrest me, and I thought it was good to go. And then I got into some more trouble, of course, and that's when they sent me to a juvenile detention center.
Mm.
And then once the police and detectives found out I was in juvenile detention for more crimes, they just charged me as an adult at 17. And that's when the judge pretty much sentenced me, and it felt like I died. And I woke up the next morning in prison and realized I wasn't dead, and I asked myself a simple question. And if you felt like you died yesterday, what would you do today if you had another chance? And I literally said out loud to the prison bars that I was going to change everything, and that's what I decided to do.
How did you find the sort of motivation to do that? How many years were you facing at that point?
4 years.
When you were 17. So you're a relatively young man and mm-hmm. knew you'd be a young man when you got out. Did you have a plan at that moment? Like, what would I do to change everything?
The first thing that came to mind was, I'm not going to disrespect anybody. I'm not going to step on anybody's toes. And I'm not going to try to prove anything to anybody. I was just going to be myself.
Is that a hard thing to do in prison?
Oh, yeah.
Especially given your history. You tended to, when you felt bad, act it out.
Yeah. So that was my plan, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I get locked up, and the first thing my cellie says, this big old guy with a raspy voice named Louisiana, he came up to me and just said, if anybody ever calls you a punk, you hit them. No matter how big they are, how many there is, you just hit them. And I just acted like I knew what he meant, but I had no idea what he meant. But as the months progressed, I saw people react to this word punk, and it was not taken lightly. It was the worst word that anybody could ever tell you. There was not a word or a list of words or a combination of words that was more pejorative, and that caused such a backlash or an outlash. So I need to respect this word.
What if you didn't respond to it?
I don't know. That was my plan. I thought it was a silly word, and then until someone called me a punk. And then I just filled up with rage, just like I seen in this environment, just like I learned. And then I was going to do exactly what I always do. I was going to grab the guy off the bunk and slam him down and hurt him. And that's when I remembered. You said you were going to change everything, and I just kind of bit my teeth, and I said, it starts now, whether you like it or not. And I did this just kind of fast-paced monologue and just said, why are you mad? And I said, well, because he called you a punk. And I said, well, are you a punk? And I said, no. And I kind of joked, well, what if he said I had a unibrow? Would it matter? And I'm like, no, because I shaved it off the day before. So I just kind of like try to make light of the situation. Eventually told myself that's not going to be best for me, and I decided to walk away. And I kind of, as I walked away, congratulated myself. But in prison, if somebody calls you a punk and you don't do anything, it pretty much implies you are a punk. So people started to treat me very aggressively. There's a list of things started to happen.
Like what?
First thing that happened, I was on the phone, and somebody came in and snatched it from me and hung up. And I was like, oh, I could fight this guy, but probably not gonna. And then people would just start talking, just running their mouth about me and just looking at me and laughing. And again, I'm a teenager.
Right.
I was 18 at this point.
Right.
And this was my world that I lived in, and nobody was going to help me. And I was completely afraid. People literally went into my cell. They broke into my cell in front of cameras and stole my store, like my Top Ramen and my chips and stuff. So I'm thinking, all right, if they're breaking into which to this day I have no idea how people can do that. I thought the guards or the correctional officers were against me too, so I got completely paranoid. And then actually that time that someone broke into my room, I went to the officers and I said, hey, did you guys take my stuff in a cell search? Because they do that randomly. And they said they didn't, so I come out of the control unit and I go into the day room, and the inmates are playing their cards and they're looking at me and laughing at me. And I'm kind of like twirling around just to see if anybody says anything that I'm going to know they know who went in my room. And then somebody gets up and calls me a snitch. So I'm like, all right, I have to do something. So I yelled the guy's name. I was like, Elvis. And he walked in. He wouldn't hear me. And finally, I caught up to him in the middle of the tier. And inmates are kind of looking out of the corner of their eyes, looking through the cell doors. And I position myself to fight because I can't go any deeper than I was. And he looks like he's ready to fight me. And I just started talking. I was like, you know what? I know what you guys think about me, and I know what you guys say about me, but I'm not about this anymore. And I'm trying to do what's best for me, and my people are out there, and I'm in here, and they don't need me in here any longer than I have to be. So you guys can continue to do and say whatever you want, but I'm going to do what's best for me. And he just looked at me confused. And I don't even know where I came up with this. And I never could have guessed what was going to happen next. He just walked away. And that night, actually, I expected, you name it, the worst thing that ever happened was going to happen. But nothing happened. The next day, he actually came up to me and said, hey, what you said to me made sense, and I respect you for that. And he went on the conversation, which I don't remember, and I actually got my stuff back. And people didn't mess with me from that day forward and just almost kind of gave me respect.
That's right.
And I didn't use my fist. Inmates did say that I kind of cussed him out or said crazy stuff to him, but I didn't say anything crazy to him. I was respectful and talking like a man.
Maybe you said it in a crazy way. The guy got through, the aggression came through that they were looking for.
Yeah. But I don't think so. I just talked to him normally, very very assertively and confidently.
I can just imagine your sense of assertiveness at 18-year-old oppositional defiant Brandon was pretty intense. I know now it just feels like, hey, man, let's talk. But then it was probably pretty wild.
Yeah, and I felt like it was a congratulations at that point, for me at least.
Yeah.
As far as the big picture in the real world goes and long-term stuff.
So keep going forward. So now we are, you've got people leaving you alone a little bit.
Yep, so then I graduated high school with a 1.87 GPA.
In prison?
No, in high school. Yeah. I got out on bail. And I should have failed classes, but my psychology teacher was like, I failed it. He said, well, have fun walking. And as he turned his head down. And the only reason I graduated with even a 1.87 GPA was because girls literally did my homework. And I go into prison, and I do a test, and I had a ninth grade level education. Mm. And again, I had no plans on ever going to college. I hated school. But I decided to change everything, and I started school. And I hated it just as much. And I remember just reading a page and just dazing out and not paying attention. So I would stop myself and I would just pay attention. And then one day I was trying to figure out this math problem and I got so frustrated and I'm by myself. And I'm trying to figure it out. I can't read it. It's like an encrypted code. that's impossible to break. And I remember I slammed the book shut and I threw it across the cell and I just, you know, just cussed and was like, forget this, it's not for me. And then that my voice came back in my head, you said you were going to change. I was like, ah. So I picked it back up and I started to read it and pay attention. And then literally the sun came up and the sun went down. And by the end of that night, I figured this one problem out. And it was like the best feeling ever. And the next problem I came to, I just started figuring out these problems all on my own. And it really just motivated me. And then in 6 months, in like record time, I ended up getting my first college level certificate. I had a 3.0 average.
So I'm a little confused. Prison, you were in prison for how long?
3.5 years altogether.
And you said you got out on bail?
Oh, sorry. That is confusing. So I got... The detectives came, I confessed, they didn't arrest me, I get into more trouble, I get arrested and go to a juvenile detention center, I get picked up, I get arrested for the adult crime, they charge me as an adult even though I was a teenager, and I get on bail, and I graduate high school, and then right when high school is over, I get sentenced to basically 4 years in prison.
Got it.
And then while in prison, first 6 months, I get a certificate, and then I just devoted my – I just started being hungry for an education.
In prison?
Yep. And I was the outcast. Like, it was not a cool thing to be – people would make fun of me and call me weird names. But also some inmates kind of respected it. I remember one of my cellies at the time came in with this just gigantic tome, this large book. And the other inmates were like, why do you have that big book? And they're like, well, I got to impress my cellie somehow. And here I am, like this basically high school dropout. And I still thought I was dumb because the school was never good to me. And I realized, like, I guess I am kind of smart. And one inmate called me the scholar, which I acted like I didn't like, but I secretly did like. So. And then I just literally focused on education. I think within 3.5 years, I got 187 college credits. I started getting petitions for classes because they were cutting out all the education in the prisons left and right.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of this, by the way, I started listening to your show as well. And then that's when I started to learn about my childhood, growing up without a father, my mother, you know, being molested, like literally hearing you tell another caller about his experience. And I was able to kind of let go of that stuff. And then... being able to understand my past and kind of figure, just deciphering this puzzle that kind of led me into prison, because prisons are filled up with 80% of the inmates are grew up without a father. That's not even including inmates that grew up without a mom. And all the inmates that I would talk to would tell me about the abuse they encountered when they were younger. Like if they didn't eat every morsel on their plate, that dad would put the boots on and beat them. And I'd see these scars. And I started to learn, like, man, this is actually my editor, Jed Dawson, he said it best, like prison became a junkyard for broken childhoods.
Well, as you know, that's what it is.
Yeah, and then so I started to learn about this from you and your show and your words and Adam's, you know, humor just empowered me to not only like listen to you guys but encouraged me to like seek help and start applying these changes.
Did you get help in prison?
I tried. I wrote a kite in prison to get a psychologist, like literally right after your show one night, but they wouldn't see me because by that point, I guess I was kind of like I wasn't getting in fights. I wasn't a threat.
You were too good.
I was too good.
They were too busy with the problems.
Yep. But one pastor met with me, and she was like smirking and saying how she was talking about Mount Rainier, which is the largest mountain in Washington State, and how it's well proportionate and how it's majestic. And I was like, what are you talking about? And this was right after an earthquake happened, which is like a 6.8 that happened in Seattle. And they were talking about the Mount Rainier exploding like it's a volcano. And she was basically essentially telling me I was holding all of this stuff in, about to explode. And then I, again, started to hear your show and started to empower me about my past. So with just like I listen to you guys like every night, which is just so crazy. I'm talking to you on the phone or talking to you guys on the radio right now. And it just helped me kind of let go a lot of that pain, a lot of that distress and insecurity, kind of accepting that I didn't have a dad, how it affects us to grow up with a mentally ill, addicted family, to be molested, how that affects us. And then,
well, the thing that your book chronicles that really jumped out at me, aside from the extraordinary story and the drama and stuff, it was like cognitive behavioral therapy playing out in real time, but self sort of motivated, self-managed CBT. It was really interesting to me. Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and I think you're a CBT fan. I was not a CBT fan, and particularly for the situation you were in, because I didn't feel like you could reach that to somebody in your condition. And boy, there was, and I was like, wow, this builds faith in that intervention. Now I understand why the data looks so good, because that's how it's supposed to go.
Yeah, and I had no idea what CBT was in prison, and then I started learning about it in college, and then you told me your insights, which I was super excited to hear about. But yeah, definitely trying to do a CBT, just to talk, very Socratic, you know, methodical conversation with myself to weigh the pros and cons and to think through things and then to understand and get empowered about my past. And then all that encouraged me. If I could help myself, then I could help other people possibly. Yeah. And that's when I was watching the news one day and a kid was getting arrested just like I was. And I feel like God revealed my purpose to prevent that kid from ending up in the very prison cell that I stood. So I decided to devote my entire life to working with youth. And as I was excited with this new purpose, I kind of looked around the walls of my prison cell, which became ever so prevalent, and I realized that that's probably not going to happen. One, I'm a kid that was shooting at other kids. Two, I didn't have an education at that point. And three, out of all the jobs in the world, I probably cannot become a counselor. No one's going to want a convicted felon to be a counselor. But I felt like that's what God wanted me to do, so I devoted my life to it. And I found faith in just prison one day. I felt like I just kind of lost my whole life. And one day, I was living with sex offender after sex offender and rapists and child molesters, and I was really just distressed about a lot of things. And a lot of my friends and family kind of faded away, or at least that's what it felt like. I felt like I was abandoned and forgotten about.
Mm.
And I got really depressed, and I decided to go to a church in prison. And I didn't really want to go, but I went anyway, and I just sat in this building and the cathedral walls and just kind of sat in the very back and didn't even pay attention, but I felt this really warm, comforting feeling, and I didn't know what it was. I can't even prove what it felt like, but I kept going, and I realized it just made me feel better. And then one day things started to get better. I felt like I didn't need to go, but then I was like, you know what? You at least owe it to go one more time to at least pay attention to see what that feeling was about. And I remember I learned something in the Bible that was pretty it was very intellectual. And I started to go back and then started to learn more things. And one day my friend, who was really depressed, wanted some help. And she asked me for advice. And I said, well, maybe this happened because you could become a better person, et cetera. And I said, look at me. I went in prison with a ninth grade level education. I actually ended up breaking my foot before I went in prison. And it sent me to this institution that has the most education available. I'm working towards an associate degree, which was unbelievable. To me, I have a business plan now. I have a purpose to work with kids. And I said, I'm more happier. I know that's incorrect, but I was more happier in prison than I was on the streets. And then it just kind of rocked me. And I said, I thought about that. And I just felt that really comfortable peace. And I thought about this world and how everything is and how this just couldn't be a mistake. And like a tear just rolled down my eye. And I was like, it felt like God was saying, like, yep, I have a plan for you. You just need to just relax and let me take care of it. And that's when I just kind of got through prison without a fight or without a scratch. Really, there was some really scary things that happened that I talk about in detail in my book. And I got out. Within an hour after I got out, I was in a college campus class on a scholarship. And that's soon when I met you. And then I applied to the University of Washington, which was the only school I ever saw myself going to. And not only did I get accepted, I got a full-ride honor scholarship. Started working with kids and sharing my story all around the state, going back to the prisons to share at their commencement speeches. You told me to get a PsyD when I was just working on my bachelor's, and I ended up graduating with my bachelor's degree, first one in my family to ever go and attend college. I went on to get my master's degree in clinical psychology. And
here we are. I got to take a quick break, Brandon, and I want to come back for a few minutes and talk about love addiction. Take a quick break. Brandon Stogsdale, the book is The Boy with the Gun. Get it on eBooks through Amazon. Be right back.
Hey, I want to take a minute to remind you all about our friends at LegalZoom.com. They want to remind us all about innovators. Now, I think one of the most exciting things about American history is the history of business innovation. Edison, Henry Ford, Steve Jobs. But it's the inventors and entrepreneurs all around us, that's right, people like you, that really drive the American economy. This month, LegalZoom celebrates innovation by helping you launch your dream. That's right, you can apply for a patent to secure your invention, register your trademark to protect your products and services, or incorporate or form an LLC and launch your business dreams. All you got to do is call or visit LegalZoom.com. They will take care of you from start to finish. They make it easy, I'm telling you.
telling you, I've used them for quite some time. They've already helped about a million businesses get started. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom, and for a limited time, get a special price on trademark, copyright, and patent applications by using the referral code Drew. Protect your creations and launch your dream at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction, or they can connect you to an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Do not forget to use that referral code Drew. Back with the Dr. Drew podcast. That yet is again another taste of the groovy tunes. Should be the groovy tunes of the Dr. Drew podcast, shouldn't it? Swinging sounds? It's not really swinging, it's groovy.
Some of them are swinging. Okay.
Brandon Stogsdale is my guest. His story is really, I think you will all agree, is amazing. And now I think you understand why I'm interested in Brandon and his life and his book, and you would be too. It's exemplary. The Boy with the Gun is the book. Please get it. It'll be time well spent. Let's spend a couple minutes, Brandon, talking about love addiction and relationships, because that's where a lot of people's pathology gets played out. And you're no exception. We're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
So things really started to just get great with all these goals and plans and work. All my goals, everything started coming into place. But there's definitely, I would say, abandonment issues, growing up without a father, neglect issues, just my mother kind of being too drunk and stuff like that. At least that's what I think. Even though, by the way, my mom visited me every week in prison, which I was incredibly grateful.
I have a feeling you had a pretty decent attachment to your mom too, because your attachment issues are nominal. It's all the behavioral oppositional stuff. So interesting, acting out stuff. Anyway, so there you go. So she's around.
Yeah. So do you want me to start in the going backwards?
Well, tell me when it gets into the trouble emerged.
All right.
You told us about that one clingy, addictive relationship you had in high school. That was already – there was the addictive stuff going on already.
Yeah. I feel like once I got out of prison, I wanted to stay single because I did awesome. Like, I felt like I was able to focus and I wasn't getting in any trouble. But I got out of prison, but I started dating multiple girls. And this is what I did in the past. I would date a lot of girls at a time that I didn't really – connect with, so I was afraid that I wouldn't get connected with, and I would, and if they cheat on me, it wouldn't matter because I was already seeing other girls.
Right,
and
you stayed safe by seeing multiple people at once.
Yeah, and I kept my distance, and if it was just one girl, I tend to be, I am clingy, I tend to put all my time and energy into them, and I smother them.
Yeah.
So if I could spread it out a little bit, and I see all these girls, and for my faith, that was just seemed to be contradictory. And it was hurting these girls, and it was very unfulfilling. But I dated a lot of girls at the time and just kind of used them for attention and affection. And that was my thing until I met one girl. And this was right out of prison. And I started spending time with her, and we ended up actually going hiking and camping and stuff. And the day we got back, I was supposed to see her at work the next day, and she didn't come to work. And everybody became worried about her. And I just got out of prison, so I was like, hey, where are you at? I just got out of prison. Nobody knows where you are. And anyway, she told me when we first met that I inspired her and she wanted to change her life and stuff. I thought that was great, and she was telling me how she wanted to move to California. And I was like, well, I didn't think it was true, but she ended up in the middle of the night packing her bags and moving to California. And I tried not to like this girl, my hardest. And I ended up, once I realized that she was gone, I realized that I liked her.
Mm-mm.
And then it was too late and she was gone, and I was really just a mess. And eventually she did come back, and I wanted to move to Seattle and start University of Washington alone, but I decided to, move in with a girlfriend. And this is a true story, but I moved in with a girlfriend. The first thing that happened was my car broke down, not a big deal, and I rode my bike to work, and my cell phone came out of my pocket and got ran over. And then my bike got stolen. I'm at UW on a full-ride honor scholarship, and I'm failing every single class.
Uh-oh.
And my girlfriend no longer wants to be my girlfriend more, and now she's my awkward roommate. And my job is treating me poorly because I'm an ex-con, and customers would be like, hey, how's it going? And I'm like, terrible. And they're like, well, why? And I was like, well, because of ABC. And they're like, well, no matter how the conversation went, they said, they always ended with, well, it can't get any worse. Well, it would get worse. And I became homeless and ended up even getting hemorrhoids, which I shuddered to share. Just a wreck, and really about to drop out of everything. And I remember that night I got a email from Paula Henson, who at Pierce College, who helped me meet you, too. She had sent this email about God and how this wealthy couple went on this event with this man, and this man picked up this filthy penny, and the woman scoffed. And she asked, like, why did you pick up that nasty penny? And he said, in confidence, because of what's inscribed in God we trust. And then I was like, do I trust in God right now? And I'm living in the library, by the way, which is open 24 hours on UW, and I have nothing, and I'm failing school. And the next morning, I get up, and I plan on dropping out, and I ended up walking. I see some pennies on the ground, and I never picked up one, but by the end of the day, I saw the most pennies on the ground I ever saw in my entire life, and I remembered what they said, and I decided to like trust in God, and I had that same warm feeling come over me again, and I decided not to give up, and ended up finding a place to stay with just enough money to like the dime. I got my grades up in the nick of time, got everything back in order, and I was volunteering a lot of my time with kids to try to help them. And everybody would tell me, like, how can you spend so much of your free time trying to help people when you're, like, not doing so well? And I never ended up ever quitting volunteering. And because of my work in the youth, with the youth, I ended up getting several awards from the University of Washington.
Wow.
One was the Mary Gates Leadership, the George Newsom Humanitarian Award, the Monroe Fellowship. And the list goes on because they all believed in me and they saw the potential I have with working with kids. So that ended up, I didn't have to worry about money anymore. So everything got back on the track, so I tried to stay single, but eventually I'd get lonely again, and I would start going back to the dating a bunch of girls at once. So this is the trend that I'm realizing. So I will get lonely. I'll start dating multiple girls so I can't attach, and then I'll find somebody and really attach to them, and then I'll become too smothering, and then I'll drive them away.
How'd you
and
break
then,
the pattern? How'd you do that? Therapy?
Well, the last girl I got really upset about, actually you helped me a lot with, definitely started therapy. That was the main reason why I started seeing a psychologist, and it basically it looked like I had a love addiction symptom.
Did you read any of
PMLD?
PMLD stuff, yeah.
Yeah, you recommended several books, which I read them all, which again I appreciate because I was a wreck.
You can get Overcoming Love Addiction is probably the best one. Or is it Facing Love Addiction? Facing Love Addiction? It's called. You can get it at the Facing Love Addiction. You can get it at our website. And it's really worth your time. Again, another book that reads pretty fast, but it's easy to pick yourself out in the patterns that she describes there. Brandon, I've got to wrap it up. I could talk to you all day.
I do want to say the book ends right before all this girl trouble happens. So it ends on a positive note.
But know that the girl trouble gets worked out too in a similar way to the way you worked everything else out. You kept working at it. You identified trouble. You asked for help. You really worked on yourself and didn't blame the world. You took responsibility for things. And now you can write another book about love addiction.
I've already started on it.
All right, and we will put that out. We will put that out for you if you wish, because people will want chapter two, I'm sure, because this is another, you know, opposition defiance and changing behaviors, big area. Relationship is the other big area. So, well, Brandon, thanks for joining me again. I really, really appreciate it. Congratulations on the book. Everybody run out and get it. It'll be time well spent, and I think you get a sense of that from listening to Brandon talk. Brandon Stogsgill, the book is The Boy with the Gun. Brandon, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
This is Corolla Digital.